some of us, it's because we're not feeling happy. We're feeling dissatisfied. Some of it might be cultural. Our parents are Buddhist and we kind of follow that in. And it seems logical. Sometimes we want to know what's going on. That was my prime reason to begin Buddhism. I wanted to know what was going on. And that happened actually when I was about 9. And I remember standing in the backyard of my home down the North Shore when I was about 9, thinking, there's got to be an answer to this. Why am I existing? Why is this house existing? Why does the universe exist? And maybe a lot of you have come to that same thing, I don't know. But I really wanted to know what was going on. It took me until the age of 23 before I really discovered Buddhism. So I was wandering around looking at various different things, different religions. And it was only when I came across Buddhism that I actually got answers to what was going on. And they really made sense. They were very logical. They were very clear. Some of them require a little bit of faith, because things like karma, we can talk about karma. We can see the effect of karma, but we can't actually see karma. It's not something tangible. Rebirth. We accept rebirth, well, I do. But again, it's not exactly empirically provable that you can actually test it. People that have experienced higher states of understanding remember their previous births, and so therefore they have no problem. But for mere mortals like myself, I don't remember that, and therefore I have to go on faith. But finding out what was going on was a prime importance to me, because I needed that to be able to survive. Other people follow or look at Buddhism because they need some peace in their lives. Their lives are in turmoil and they want to find some place of peace. And so, therefore, there's various different reasons. And Buddhism, in a sense, it's kind of interesting in a nutshell. Yes, it is very simple. That first statement I made, find out what creates a good result for myself and others, and doing that and not doing negative is really absolutely the whole deal. Because we want results. We do stuff for results. And we want peace, harmony, love, compassion in our lives. We don't want anger, frustration, disappointment in our lives. And so we look at Buddhism and go, okay, well, how does that happen? So we go right back to the very, very first teachings of the Buddha, which all of you know, don't you? Just nod. Yes. And they are, what was the first teachings of the Buddha? Yeah. You can whisper it. The Four Noble Truths. So when the Buddha became enlightened, it was an interesting thing. One of the first group of people he came across was when he first left the palace to go wandering, because he'd seen birth, death, old age and suffering, and he wanted to know what was going on. And he ended up with a group of Hindu ascetics who were wandering around. There's about 7 of them. And he thought, well, these guys are practicing a very austere practice of spirituality, really. I'll follow them. So he ended up following them for a while. But he found out that their methods of physical deprivation were actually causing him too much grief. And his mind became weak, because his body became very weak. So he left them and decided that he was going to find enlightenment, which he did under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. But the first people he came across were these group of guys, and one of them said to him, because he'd changed incredibly since they'd known him, his whole body had changed, his energy had changed, and so one of them said to him, are you a god? And he said, no, I'm not a god. And they said, are you a man? He said, no, I'm awake. And that's such a powerful statement, that he was awake. In other words, he knew what was going on. But then he had to decide what he was going to teach. Once you're awake and you've seen everything, and the Buddha actually said, there are many things that I know that I will not talk about. Because he maybe can talk about other existences, other realms, whatever. But unless they're relevant to us becoming enlightened, they just become information. And information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not wisdom. And wisdom leads to realization. So he left a lot of stuff out, but he got it down really essentially to the Four Noble Truths. And he had to also talk to the people at the time to give them information that they would recognize, that they would actually see it. He didn't start off with the view of emptiness, of dependent origination and emptiness, because the people would have gone, what? They wouldn't know what he was talking about. So he had to give them something that really resonated, and that first noble truth was there is suffering or dissatisfaction. That's something we can all understand. Dissatisfaction. Not getting what we want and receiving what we don't want. Bad grades. So when we see that, he was able to make it very succinct. We have suffering. And that's a truth for ourselves, for every being. We can look at beings non-human and see how they suffer. So that was really evident. Very clever. And then he said, so there's no point just knowing that you suffer. You also need to know why. Why do I suffer? What's the reason? Why do I have dissatisfaction? Why do things come and go without my control? Why do things arrive when I don't want them to, even though I wish they'd go away? So he then talked about the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering was us. It wasn't external, it was internal. We create the cause for suffering and for our happiness, which is actually great news. In other words, what I can say to you all, it's all your fault. And that's the good news, because if it's someone else's fault, we have no control over it. So our experience of suffering and happiness is related to us and the way we see things. It can be raining outside, and if your plants haven't been watered, you think that's wonderful, and if you want to go on a picnic, it's a terrible shame. We interface with the external world and our internal world and with our emotions, and we make choices. Oh, this is terrible. This is perfect. This is wonderful. This is awful. Constantly doing that, referring all the time to ourselves. So those results are a result of our karma, our cause and effect. We only have two possibilities in the universe. Well, there's three, actually. We either have cause and effect, where you create a cause and then there's an effect. We have complete randomness. There's no cause and effect. Things just happen. I plant an apple seed and it turns into a Mercedes-Benz. No, it doesn't work that way. So we work on the fact that we have cause and effect. The other third possibility is that we have some randomness and some cause and effect, which ends up with randomness. So we can throw that one out. So we live our lives just even without knowing it. We live our lives on with cause and effect. So there is a cause to our suffering. And we've created it. That's the good news. Then he said there is actually a path out of that suffering. There's a way to remove that suffering. And the final noble truth was, there is a result. The result is freedom from that. Cessation of suffering. So we have those four. They were the foundation of Buddhist thought. Totally radical in those times, 500 BC. People didn't know how to look at it that way. they would think that it's coming from the gods or, you know, whatever superstition, but never related it back. It's so simple, isn't it? Relating it back to ourselves. That's where our power is. And so when we start to realize that, then we have some control. Control over our emotions, control over our actions, control over our thoughts. And that's the essential message that I see in Buddhism, is that we can transform ourselves. We can change ourselves. But it requires effort. It requires wisdom. It requires awareness, our attention. It just doesn't happen. I remember when I first taught meditation many years ago to some people, they weren't Buddhists, they just wanted to learn to meditate. And they thought if you just close your eyes, then something just magical happens. That's meditation. Sit there, I'll meditate. And all this amazing stuff happens. And one guy said to me after 2 days, I taught him, he was actually a movie producer, and I taught him to meditate. And he rang me up after 2 days and he said, look, I've tried it twice and it didn't work. It didn't work. And I said, what didn't work? He said, I don't know, it just didn't work. I'd spent an hour and a half with him explaining to him that meditation is a process of working with the mind and strengthening the mind and calming the mind, but he didn't get it. He thought he was going to go somewhere. I think he was in the movies, you see. Being in the movies, he thought you close your eyes and all of a sudden it just opens up and you have this amazing experience. And a lot of people still think meditation is like that. One woman came to me and said, oh, look, my friend, when she meditates, she gets a blue light. Can you show me how to get the blue light? I went, no. Sorry. Can't do the blue light. So that's the transformation. Transformation about working with our own mind. If we think happiness is out there, we're going to be continually disappointed. Continually disappointed, because even the most perfect object that you have, if you're in love with your Maserati or your Rolls Royce, it will rust. Sorry, Rolls Royce company, but your cars do rust. And then disappointment. And if you look at any object that you've got, and all of us have done this, oh, I really want to own that, I really want to own that, it'd be great. Half the enjoyment is the anticipation of owning it, and then you've got it, and then you're like, oh, great. Oh, fabulous, I've got it now. Yeah, well, I have something else now. And then we keep more and more thinking that the more we own, and this is the nature of advertising, actually, the more we own, if you own this, you are going to be happy. It might be a new electric toothbrush. You will be happy. And so constantly we keep reaffirming this idea that getting something externally is going to make us happy. And if that was the case, all you would need is one Rolls Royce and that's the end of the day, or extremely wealthy. I just heard that the guy that owns Amazon is now the richest guy in the world. $140 billion. I wonder if he's any happier when he was at $120 billion. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you have, and there's an old saying in Buddhism, you can be chained by a chain of gold or a chain of straw. If you're chained, you're chained. So if money was the product that was going to give us eternal happiness, then fabulous, get rich. But unfortunately, it doesn't. That doesn't mean that poverty is also the way to go. Oh, well, look, I'll just get rid of everything. I won't have any clothes, and I won't have any food, and I won't... Then you die. So that doesn't work either. This is why, in a sense, Buddhism talks about the middle way. So by looking at the techniques that Buddhism has, the actual methods that it has, and thankfully we've been so lucky that the Buddha taught for 50 years. And it's said that he taught 84,000 dharmas to cover our 84,000 delusions. It's amazing. And you can literally find an answer to every problem in the Buddha Dharma. A girl came to me, oh, this was many years ago, and she wanted some counselling, and I said, what's wrong? She said, oh, I met this incredible guy, he's so spiritual. So spiritual. I went, so why are you coming to see me? She said, oh, there's only one problem. I said, what's the problem? She said, oh, he's married with two little girls. I said, that's not a little problem, that's a big problem. And she said, yeah, but he's got so much knowledge. I said, yeah, but his fundamental morality is wrong. He's cheating on you, he's cheating on his wife, and he's cheating on his two daughters. So whether he has a mind of an encyclopedia, his actions are not wholesome. And someone, either you, his wife, or his two daughters, or all of you, will end up with sorrow from his actions. And she went, oh, but he's so spiritual. I went, no, sorry. The basis of spirituality is based firstly on morality, how you conduct yourself. And so anyway, she went away and she rang me back 2 weeks later. She said, no, I've given him a miss. She said, I thought about it. She said, you were right. Got rid of him. So this is the thing. It's knowledge can be like a possession. You could throw it around and look like you're really smart and hope people will admire you, but unless it turns into wisdom. And so do you know what the difference between knowledge and wisdom is? What would you say? This is where I get to ask a question and you all sit there and look at me and not answer it. Come on, what's the difference between knowledge and wisdom? I've actually said it here before. I can wait. I have patience. What do you reckon?
Wisdom is gained from experience.
It's experience, but it's the way you use your knowledge. That is wisdom. So I can have all the knowledge in the world, but unless I use it in a particular way that is beneficial, then there is, and that's called wisdom. And if I use wisdom long enough, then I develop what's known as realizations, where I actually have, I don't have to think about, oh, is that right or wrong? I know. The difference between a Buddha and ourselves, many things, but one of them is a Buddha doesn't think, a Buddha knows. Buddha doesn't have to think, oh, maybe not. He just knows. And the difference between us and a Buddha is that a Buddha is never distracted. We practice meditation not to be distracted. A Buddha doesn't have to project or protect himself with meditation because he's never in that state of dissolution. He's always present. Always present. And so our meditation practice is very important. It's where we go internally and we quieten our mind. We calm our mind down. Because it's very evident when our minds are agitated, we're not happy. If we're feeling frustrated or anxious, we have anxiety or depression, all related to an agitated mind, then we're feeling really uncomfortable. And the antidote to that is the practice of meditation, calming the mind down, settling it down. And meditation is the only practice where you deal directly with the mind. I teach Tai Chi. People say, oh, that's meditation. No, that's a mindfulness practice and very beneficial meditation. But meditation is where you let go all physical activity and you just work with the mind. And you get to know the mind. You get to understand. You actually see your agitation and realize that it's not beneficial. And when you've done a weekend retreat on meditation, at the end of that weekend, you think, I just feel okay. I actually feel okay. You're not grasping for something. You're not pushing something away. You feel content in your own skin. That's happiness. where you're not looking for something or trying to push something away. You patiently accept what's coming to you and you feel okay where you are. We have this illusion that tomorrow is going to be better. That's not necessarily so. Sorry to tell you. Oh, it'd be better. If only. In fact, a book I've always promised to write, which I haven't even got to yet. I don't think I have enough wisdom, but not yet anyway. Maybe in another 100 years. One of the chapters is the if only chapter. If only, dot, 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 then I'll be happy. And you can fill in the blank, dot, dot, dot. If only. Oh, if only that person was in my life, then I'd be happy. If only that person was out of my life, then I'd be happy. And we're constantly changing. If only I had, then I'd be happy. And when we live our lives at that future grasping, we actually don't enjoy the journey. We only have the journey. The destination is really unpleasant. It's called death. So unless we are enjoying the journey, unless we're being meaningful in our journey, then the future doesn't look after itself anyway. Our action is here, right here and now. Mindfulness, our awareness now. What is my mind doing now? Is it thinking negative thoughts? Is it thinking grasping thoughts? Is it being agitated? Or is it being content? And so we can look at ourselves and keep referring back and looking at our awareness and saying, where am I now? This is very simple Buddhism. We're not talking about esoteric practices here. Just very simple, basic, in a nutshell stuff. What is my mind doing right now? And if you can ask yourself that question, a very simple question, you can then see what it's doing. Oh, it's being really angry at that person sitting in front of me because they're making a noise and I'm trying to study and it's really getting on my nerves or whatever. Or going, okay, this is just what's happening. I'm just going to patiently accept this. There's nothing I can do about it. In the great words of Shantideva in the 9th century, the great Buddhist master who wrote the Bodhisattva Caryavatara, or the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, my most famous statement from his book that I really, really like, and I use it quite a lot in stress management classes for companies. If it can be fixed, why worry? If it can't be fixed, why worry? That's it. By recognizing that, we fix the things that we can fix, and we let go the grasping or the attachment or the aversion towards the things that we can't fix. We let it go. We go, okay, I can't do anything about that. So instead of staying up nights and being frustrated about the things we can't change, we just have to accept it. It's not easy. The practice of Buddhism is, in fact, one Tibetan Lama called Chogyam Trungpa, in the beginning of his book, it's called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's a very, very clever book. And he said, the opening words, the Buddhist path is very difficult. Better not begin. And then he said, however, if you have begun, you can't stop. You can't. What, are you going to become ignorant? You have a little bit of teachings, you understand a bit about karma, you understand about meditation. What are you going to go, nah, not doing that? What are you going to do? So you can take the practice simply and work with it. Work with the mind directly. Finding out the things that you need to do and the things that you don't need to do. When you look at the, and as I said, Buddhism has some very complex practices, but when we get down to the essential stuff, it's very simple. We're just working with our own mind, our own consciousness. So after the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, he then looked at the Eightfold Path. And we'll look at each of them to begin with. Does everyone know the Eightfold Path? Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. could you recite it immediately to me? First one is right view. So right view. It's, and I'll read this because it's kind of nicely put. Vision of the nature of reality and the path of transformation. So right view is understanding how things work. Right view would be understanding that things are impermanent. That when we create a cause, a negative cause, we're going to end up with a negative result. When we create a negative, a positive cause, we end up with a positive result. So the right view is understanding how things are going on. It's the first one. The fact that things have a causal nature to them, and for the fact that they come from a cause, means they're empty of an inherent existence. So the emptiness of every object in the room is the same. It's all empty of an inherent existence. There is no greater value between this cup and this table except what I put on it. That's called imputed value. If I particularly think this is the best antique table I've ever had, I'm very attached to it. I will fight you over it because I want to keep it. This is an antique. You don't see it as an antique, but I'm telling you this is an antique and this is fantastic and you can't have it. That cup's worth nothing. That cup may be Ming Dynasty, worth $500,000, and the table's worth, what, $200? Who knows? Doesn't matter. This grasping and attachment is where we start to develop our suffering. And so right view is seeing how things actually function. How they work. Are there any questions, sir? No? Making sense, I hope. So the next one is right thought. This is right thought or right attitude. Liberating emotional intelligence in your life and acting from love and compassion. An informed heart and feeling mind that are free to practice letting go. This is a really interesting thing. There's one of our lamas that was teaching at our centre. Someone was asked, the mother actually asked, she said, what's the difference between love and attachment? Right, and just such a simple answer. What's the difference between love and attachment? Love is wishing the other person to be happy. Attachment is wishing for yourself to be happy. Simple. In other words, if we attach ourselves to somebody and we ring them up 17 times a day because we're so in love with them, I can guarantee they won't be hanging around too long. Well, maybe 16 times. Hello, how are you? Now you put down the phone first. Now you put down the phone first. And that can go on ad infinitum. And so that kind of attachment just drives people nuts and pushes them away. But when you have great love for someone, you wish for their happiness. Right speech. This is about how you speak to people and how about being truthful and being as clear as you can for the benefit of others. Not yelling at people. You can yell at people if you have the right motivation. If a child's about to stick their hand in a fire, you don't say, now don't, sweetheart. That will burn you. You yell out at the top of your voice, no! And the kid pulls the tab back. The motivation is fine. The volume is scary for the child. They think they're a terrible person yelling at them. But what you're doing is you're doing it through compassion. In Buddhism, they term that wrathfulness. There's a difference between wrathfulness and anger, actually. Anger is the desire to harm. Wrathfulness can be out of compassion for someone else and using a loud volume and being seeming like you're very aggressive, but in fact actually you're helping that person. So right speech is non-harmful communication. If you look at all the Eightfold Path, it's about not harming others and in turn not harming ourselves. Wonderful thing I came across in Buddhism when in the early stages is, what is good for me, truly good for me, is good for others. What is good for others is truly good for me. When I'm compassionate to somebody else, that's good for them. But I'm also developing myself when I'm doing that. It feels good for a start. On the minus smallest level of reward, being compassionate feels good. And so there's no downside to that. These are all truths within Buddhism that are actually things that we can relate back to. That's the thing I particularly liked about Buddhist practice, is that I could relate it back to my life and see that these simple practices actually do work. They actually do work. Saying sorry to someone when you've done something wrong puts out the fire. Trying to stand your position and argue for your position and become aggressive when people accuse you of doing something wrong does not create harmony. There was an interesting story of someone I know who was working in he was an accountant, and he just got a new job in an accountancy firm. It was open plan. And he went to my teacher and said to him, what do I need to do, you know, for this new job? He said, every time you make the slightest mistake, he said, you go and tell your boss. He went, really? That's really embarrassing. He said, no, just the slightest mistake, go and tell the boss. And because it was his teaching, right. So every time he made the slightest mistake, he'd go into his boss and say, I'm sorry, boss, I did this, it's wrong. 6 months later, 25 people got retrenched and he got a promotion. Because his boss could trust him. He knew he wasn't hiding anything. Just really simple practices. Nothing too clever. So that's right speech, non-harmful communication. Right action. This is ethical behaviour towards others. Obviously, not stealing. Not creating problems for people by doing unhelpful physical actions. And good point here, the principle of non-exploitation of oneself and others. Not exploiting people. Not pretending that the watch you're selling them is really a Rolex when it's actually a cop. And the five precepts. So really, that's ethics. Ethics in Buddhism is not just a whole list of things you can't do, although that's helpful. How the monks and nuns started off with the Buddha in the early days was that there were no vows. The Buddha just got people together and there were no vows. And someone came along and they said, oh, Buddha, I just stole a chicken for you. The Buddha went, okay, no stealing, right. Monks and nuns are not allowed to steal. And so it went on. And so all the vows built up because people didn't know how to behave. And so the Buddha gave the rules. And I remember a friend of mine became a monk. This is going back 25-30 years. And he had a normal life up until then. He'd been in a company and various things, had girlfriends and whatever. And then he decided he really wanted to become a monk, and I said to him, because monks have, in the Tibetan tradition, have 256 vows, and I said to him, what, is that constricting? He said, no, it's absolute freedom. And at that point, I kept thinking, not sure about that one. But years later, I actually saw it in action. because I'd taken a vow not to lie. And I was went to this person's place. My practice was in Shiatsu, massage. And I went to a new client's house. And she was lying down. You do Shiatsu on the floor on a mat, Japanese system. And brand new client, very wealthy client actually, lived in a house that was sold, I saw the other day, for $50 million. That was a very wealthy client. And the phone rang. And she said, quick, answer it and tell them I'm not here. Brand new client, woman in the house. I said, what? I ring up, I answer the phone and say, oh, don't worry, I'm the burglar. I said, I'm not going to, I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. And I said, no, I can't do that. You're here. And she said, oh, what? And she was trying, and I said, look, we've got two choices. You get off and answer the phone and talk to them. I tell them that you're not available. Because I had a vision of her husband ringing up and going, where's so-and-so? And I go, oh, she's not here. Well, who are you? big problem. Or, final solution, hey, wisdom, how about we don't answer the phone? She went, oh, that's a great idea. And then I remember someone rang me up and they said, I'm going to tell you something, and when I tell you, if so-and-so rings you and asks if I've spoken to you, you've got to say no. I said, no, I'm not entering into that contract. I said, you know what? Don't tell me. I said, because I'm not going to lie for you. She went, oh, okay. To this day, I never knew what she was going to tell me. But, you know, just keeping that, and it gives you a freedom. If you say you're not going to do it, you're not going to do it. If I know that stealing is a problem, it's going to create a cause and then an effect. If when we're cheating on our tax return, our bank account was going down at the same time, we'd stop immediately. The unfortunate thing about karma is there's a gap between the cause and the effect, so we don't necessarily see it. But I got a carpenter to do something at my mother's place the other week. Very good carpenter. And he said to me, he said, oh, I'll give you the price without the GST. And I thought about it. I thought, oh, that's tempting. I'll save my mother some money. I look after her finances. She's very old. And the GST was there and I paid him the full amount. I didn't want the problem. I didn't want the karma of cheating on the government. Whether I agree with GST or not, it's a law and I have to abide by it. So I paid him the money. Now, whether he keeps the GST, because I paid him cash, but I gave him the GST within the cash. Whether he wants, that's not my problem. I don't have to deal with it. You know? If he wants to pay his GST, that's his problem. But I'm free. I don't have to think, I'm cheating. So this is what I really understood about when this monk said, when you're not allowed to do something, when you've made a pledge not to do something, you're actually free from worrying about it. You don't have to do it. So I got it in the end. Right livelihood. Don't become a robber. It's not a right livelihood. And it's not very lucrative. There's many people in jail where it hasn't worked for. Looking at what your actions do. Whether you're helping society. Because right livelihood creates a harmonious society. And don't work for a company that's not ethical. Very easy. Make choices like that. Investigate. And it's a grey area in the fact that sometimes you think something's a good action and other people, depending on political party you're with and some whatever, you know. We look at this thing, the Adani mine that's happening, and there's a grey area. Some people want to protect the environment and some people think that it's going to give jobs. Well, we have to make a decision based on our best knowledge. And it's not for me to be moralistic and say one's better than the other. That has to be for each individual person to understand. That's the beauty of our Buddhism. Each person has their own Buddhism. Each person is accountable for their own actions and for their own thinking. And that's why we have to develop ourselves to the best possible level to make a very clear decisions about how we look after them. And so we make decisions with right livelihood. Who are we going to work for? Maybe it's clear for us that we don't want to work for a company that's destroying the Brazilian rainforest. We go, no, that's really going to harm a lot of beings. I'm not going to do that. And so we can do ethical behaviour. Maybe it's doing aged care for people or whatever. But it doesn't have to be. You could be doing economics or accountancy or whatever for companies that are doing great beneficial things for the planet. Or you can be working for someone that's not doing great stuff. And that then becomes right livelihood. So again, looking at how it's beneficial for ourselves and others, that's creating the right environment for our mind. Right effort. Consciously directing our life energy to the transformative path of creative and healing action that fosters wholeness, conscious evolution. Right effort also means doing our practice, knowing that doing some meditation is beneficial for us, and doing that. And being persevering. That's the hard bit. Being consistent. But you also have to be careful that you don't beat yourself up about it either. You have to have some compassion for yourself. If you become the righteous Buddhist, you're going to be probably doing as much harm as if you're a little bit lazy. Because you then become difficult to be around and you become judgmental. You have to have compassion. One Lama put it this way. He said, you have to love your angels and your devils equally or they will harm you. In other words, we have to recognise the things that we're not good at or that we're probably indulgent with and not necessarily continue the indulgence but at least not beating ourselves up. What you don't want is this constant fear and guilt. I was talking to a Jewish client of mine the other day and we were talking about guilt. She said, Jewish people invented guilt. And she said, the Catholics made a religion out of it. And she said, where does guilt feature in Buddhism? And I said, it doesn't. Guilt is sitting in the car and not starting the engine. Oh, I feel terrible that I've done that to you. Oh, I feel awful. That's guilt. See, I feel awful. I was in Greece many, many years ago in the mid-80s. And it was so refreshing. A taxi driver was driving me from the hotel to the airport. And in those days, it was drachmas actually in Greece in those days. That coinage. And I saw on the meter, it was 8 drachmas. He said, oh, it's 15 drachmas. And I went, but it's 8 on the meter. I said, you're ripping me off. He said, yeah, I'm stealing from you. And I went, yeah, he said, I'm ripping you off, yeah. And he said, and if you want your bags out of the back boot, he said, you'll pay me, won't you? And I went, you got it. And in a funny kind of way, that was really refreshing. He was a totally honest robber. and I kind of, it was really a pittance of amount of money. It was something between $1 or $2 extra, you know, I mean, really. And I was in India in around 2006, I was in Bangalore, and I took a little tuk-tuk back to my hotel and went, group of us were staying in a 5-star hotel, and this guy in rags, he took me in his little bicycle back to the hotel, and he'd originally said, I don't know what it was, 30 rupees or something, I can't remember. And he said, 50 rupees. And I went, you said it was 30. And he looked at me and he looked at the hotel and he went... I went, fine, I get it. He was so poor. And he'd inflated it. But he was like, yeah, you're going to rip me off? Look where you're staying. You know, it would take him a whole year's pay to stay for half an hour in the place. So, again, right livelihood. So... right effort. Okay. Right mindfulness. This is the development of our awareness. Okay? Being aware of what we're actually doing. And that's going right back to the beginning where I was saying, just looking at our mind and looking what our mind is doing. In fact, I'll read this. Complete or thorough awareness. We can either be ignorant or go for enlightenment. There's your choice, really. Developing awareness. If you hold yourself dear, watch yourself well. Levels of awareness, mindfulness of things, oneself, feelings, thought, people, and reality. So how are we interacting with people? Looking at that very directly and developing this internal awareness about what's going on. This develops our wisdom. Right concentration, or there's your meditation practice. It's easy to sit down and be tired and meditate and go, oh yeah, whatever. There's one guy I know who used to meditate for 3 hours every afternoon. Or as I was talking to him, his friend called out, does that include snoring? And so he would sit down every afternoon on his bed and he'd go to sleep for 3 hours and he'd call that meditation. And he wasn't a Buddhist and he came to our Buddhist centre one time and we did 20 minutes of meditation. And he said to me at the end, he said, oh, that's way too hard. I like my practice a lot better. Okay, that's fine. So, really developing our mind through meditation is such a crucial element of Buddhist practice. Calming the mind down. When I was down in Melbourne a number of times doing really quite long practices, we'd go three weeks, we'd do a retreat. And the retreat was often 7 or 8 hours of meditation a day, doing visualizations and mantras, tantric practices. Really complex stuff. And at the end of it, my teacher used to say, if your mind has calmed down just a little bit, then wonderful result. Just a little bit. He didn't say, oh, have you received all these incredible realizations, but if your mind has just settled. And recognizing that state, and that's where you engender your, or you find the joy of meditation is by actually doing it and recognizing it after you've done it, the state of mind that you're in. That your mind is content, peaceful, and aware. And when you develop that, the more you develop that, then the more, interestingly enough, that you develop the realizations of the Buddhist path. They say that the view of emptiness, dependent origination and emptiness, only comes through developing your practice. There are many, many people I've come across who have never really done much practice, but they're highly intelligent. And you give them the understanding of emptiness, and they find it really hard to grasp. And then over time, through practice, they start to see it. And it's through that practice of meditation and mindfulness practice that you start to develop your understanding of Buddhism, and then it becomes more beneficial and it starts to work for you. So are there any questions so far? Yep.
Is there a difference between like right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness?
Ah, that's a good question. Is there a difference between right mindfulness or wrong mindfulness? Well, I guess it depends on wrong mindfulness would be really putting your mind towards things that don't have great benefit. Okay, that would be a very simple answer. So think about that. What would be, and I'm throwing this question back to you, what would be things where you had deep awareness and concentration on that weren't going to be beneficial?
Games. Like playing games.
Yeah, to a degree. You have to be really careful with that. You could spend your time. It depends where you spend your time. Yes, playing games can be enjoyable, but if you're doing it 24 hours a day, I would say absolutely. But you could also be plotting how to steal something from somebody. I'm taking it to a bigger extreme.
Mm.
But yeah, if you're spending a lot of time. But I also recognise that some of the games that you play actually develop a very fast mind. They're not all a downside to it. Your reflexes get very quick. It does work on a particular side of your brain. So I can't discredit, but if you're spending all your time playing games and you know that you've been there for 6 hours and it's 3 in the morning and you can't put yourself away and you haven't studied or you've got to go to lectures the next day and then you don't go, then you have to say that's definitely wrong mindfulness. So again, it's up to you. No one's going to come along and tell you. You can do it in the secrecy of your own room. But you know that that's not going to work, that exactly. But I'm not saying, oh no, we're not monks and nuns. We're not living that kind of life. So we have to be out in the world. You know, you can say going to a party is wrong mindfulness because it's not focused on the Dharma. But you could be going to a party and talking to people and being really kind and helpful and creating harmony and compassion and love. You can be going and playing a game, which is really enjoyable. It's good for your health. So you have to be a little bit more open than being too, you know, too zealous about things. Fanatics aren't helpful in Buddhism. Really not helpful. You don't want to be so narrow that all you have is Buddhism and that's all you talk, because in the end, you become too rigid. And you become judgmental. I look at those people. They're not practicing like I do. I practice really hard, but they don't. You develop pride, and then pride is very unhelpful for your practice. So you have to be open and compassionate. And you can't lecture people, unless they're your children. Then you can lecture. And by about the age of 10, they won't listen to you anyway, so... But, you know, that's good. But a good question, yeah. Have a look at what you're doing. And you'll know whether you're wasting time or not. And occasionally waste some time, see what happens. Any other questions so far? Yep.
You mentioned dependent origination. What is dependent origination?
What's dependent origination? Oh, okay. So we're going to be here for about another 4 hours. Okay? Everything is dependent. Thank you. Okay. So, for everything to exist in this room, it has to have come in dependence on something else. For this table to exist, it has to depend on the manufacturer. The manufacturer has to depend on being born on the planet to manufacture things. You can take it in any direction you want. Everything is dependent. Everything. There is nothing that springs from nothing. The universe is dependent. And therefore, if it's dependent, and this is where the two come together, these are the two sides of the coin. You have emptiness and dependent origination. So everything being dependent, we're dependent on our parents are dependent on their parents, and so forth. Nothing's in isolation, and so it goes back and back and back and back and back. So there is nothing that comes into existence except dependence on something previously. And that's the truth of it. Therefore, okay, so this table is dependent on having its legs. Whereabouts is the table? This is where we look at emptiness. Whereabouts is the table? Is the table the legs? No. They're the legs. Is the top the table? Oh yeah, that's the table. Okay, well if I take the legs away and put it on the ground, is it a table? Not really. It's also dependent on us calling it a table. It's dependent on imputing this to be a table. For a kangaroo, it's a hop over. Kangaroo goes, no, I don't need a table, and it's just something to hop over. To an ant, it's a mountain. See, it all depends. Depends on the imputation and the fact that everything comes together. And everything falls apart. So if I become attached to this antique table, I'm going to be really disappointed because one day it's just going to fall apart. Because I want it to be permanent. So nothing's permanent. Because things can come together, they fall apart. That's the truth. And so when you have that, you start to lose your attachment. Because you start, well, I guess maybe we can use the analogy of a rainbow. If we're looking at a beautiful rainbow in the sky, we can do two things. We can look at it and go, oh, it's beautiful. Or we can fumble for our camera to take a picture of it to show people the amazing rainbow that we've seen. See, I saw that rainbow. Or we can just experience it. And I'm not against taking photos, but I've recently been in situations, I was in Vietnam after Christmas, and seeing people at a performance all standing up with their cameras or their phones taking the performance. Oh, yeah, I think I've got it. Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, great. And I'm thinking, there's the performance, and you want to capture it. And then I thought to myself, I bet you those people go back. It was a dance performance in Cambodia, actually. They're really good dancers. And I can imagine them going back on their little screen and saying to their friends, oh, look at this amazing performance I've seen. It was so good. And the friend's going, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, that's great. Mm, yeah, right. Mm, fantastic. Oh, yeah, wow. Gee, you're great, aren't you? You took that from there. Oh, thank you. And in the end, I'm thinking, the performance is out there. Experience it directly. It's going to be gone. That's not going to give you that much joy. It'll trigger a memory. That's fine. No problem. I take photos too. But in the end, the experience of it's very different to your little television screen. And so it's allowing ourselves to let go some of that stuff. I, just coming here tonight, there was a guy walked across a red light with him, and I was turning the corner. Phone, just stepped off the curb. It wasn't going very fast. I beeped him and he went, kept walking. And I just thought, oh no, that's a lack of awareness. And unfortunately, there are more people getting knocked over by walking along with their phones and being distracted. And so, I also talk in my business management stuff, I say to people, I'm going to get you on this one. How many people sleep with their phone beside them? Come on. Oh, by the way, I don't. Okay, here's a little bit of advice. When you sleep with your phone beside you, you are psychologically connecting yourself to being awake. Even subtly. Okay, here's the next one. Who, if they wake up at 3 in the morning, check their phone? Anyone? Alright, you all pass. That's good. Because some business people do. Put your and then I said to this business group, I said, oh, why are you doing that? Oh, it's my alarm clock. Get an alarm clock. Again, psychologically, connecting yourself to that phone is bad for your sleep patterns. You're really subtly just getting there. I think we've hit a funny bone here. But really, what I would suggest is that you really do put your phones in another room and get yourself an alarm clock. There'll be a rush on Kensington alarm clock sellers hopefully tomorrow, because it's actually helpful when you let that go. We're constantly, look, I know we use our phones a lot, and we do, I do too. I use it for communication, checking my emails and all that stuff. But you need to give your mind a rest. And so let go of that subtle connection. Oh, there's my phone, I'm connected. And put it in another room, charge it in another room overnight. Also, there's a lot of electrical waves coming past, not so good for you being that close to it. So, you know, those are things that we can work with ourselves and go, okay, how about I just clear my space? When I go and see a client, I never take my phone in to see the client. And I got a call one time from a long-term client of mine. He said, I've been trying to get you for an hour and a half. And I said, yeah. I said, when I go to see a client, I don't even take my phone in to see them. I said, but in your case, I'll make sure I do. And he went, hold it. I said, no, I'll bring my phone in when I see you and I'll answer it while I'm treating you. And he went, oh, hold it, that's not good. And about 2 years later, he did the same thing. I didn't say anything. But when I got to his place, I said, now lie down on the shiatsu mat. Oh, just a bit. I just want to put my phone on beside you. And he went, okay, I get it. We can actually let go of it sometimes. Unfortunately, it's even younger kids now that are getting really hooked into it. I've just noticed one school has banned phones during the day. Completely banned it. And do you know what's happened? Kids are communicating with each other. They're a secondary school, and the school said, we've just made a rule, can't use your phones during the day. And the girls, it was a girls' school, and the girls came back and said, oh, it was really hard at first, but actually now we're talking to each other, communicating with each other. Which is, and the teacher said, the headmistress said, yeah, it's a lot noisier in the playgrounds now, because everyone's talking. You know, and the person said, well, so what's the discipline if someone brings their phone? She said, we just take it off it and give it to them at the end of the day. There's no great punishment. It's just what happens. So there's some of the things about awareness that's important. Look at what you're doing and see what's beneficial and what isn't. You know, getting exercise. And it's great that Unibuds does projects with exercise and basketball and different things. Really healthy. Very good. Because we have to look after this physical body as much as we look after our minds. And that's also, in a sense, right livelihood, in the way that we actually physically look after ourselves. If we eat junk food all the time, we eat heaps and heaps of sugar and food that isn't great for our bodies, then our concentration levels drop. We're not as healthy, and if we're not as healthy, we then don't have the focus that we need to do what we need to do in the university, in our studies. So, you know, just right livelihood is also looking after ourselves in right nutrition. That's important. Okay, so what I also wanted to talk about is the non-virtues in terms of Buddhism. So we've looked at Four Noble Truths. Cause of suffering. There is suffering, cause of suffering, way of suffering, a cessation of suffering. We've looked at the Eightfold Path. And now we just look at the various karmas that are related. And what I'm going to do is, if I can find this here, these are the results of the non-virtues. Okay? And this is kind of good to know about. And this is particularly a Tibetan teaching that comes from a lama called Pabongka Rinpoche. So there's a ripened result. There's experience congruent with the cause and actions congruent with the cause. So killing, the ripened result, can be rebirth in the three lower realms. The results congruent with the cause, experience congruent with the cause. So if you don't end up in a lower rebirth, you're in a human rebirth, you'll have a short life, ill health, many troubles, and no success in your activities. So if you spend this life killing, going out and doing a lot of fishing or killing animals or hunting, then if you're born a human, you'll have a short life next life. Actions congruent with the cause is you'll have a habitual desire to kill and harm others. And that's the result of killing in this life. So if you go out of your way. Now, naturally, if we just live our lives, things will be harmed, even walking. But it's the intention of wanting to kill something. There's the problem. I have a mouse at the moment in my house. And that mouse is the cleverest mouse I've ever come across. I haven't come across a lot of mice, but this mouse is so smart. So I bought these cages, right? The no-kill cages. Well, firstly, the mouse won't walk into them. He's worked out that I'm not going in there, that's not clever. So I built another, I bought another one. I spent a fortune online of these no-kill cages. And there's this other one that's got a little tube. And you put the food on, and he walks in, and it goes close to the door. Somehow this mouse has worked out. I think he keeps the door open with his back foot while he's stealing the food. And people I've spoke, clients of mine that I've seen, they go, "Well, why don't you kill him?" I went, "I'm not going to kill a mouse. I don't want to kill a mouse. But I certainly want to get rid of him." So I'm devising more and more elaborate plans to catch the mouse. So far they're not working. I even bought some stuff from Bunnings called the Big Cheese, which is a mouse attractant. It doesn't kill them, but they reckon it's even tastier than peanut butter. This mouse isn't interested. One day I was in a temple in it was a retreat actually with one of the lamas, and it was up, and they'd made this retreat centre into a temple. And quite spontaneously, I was standing next to this guy, and he was a new guy. It was a summer retreat. I don't think he'd been involved in Buddhism before. And he's standing, there's all the statues of the Buddha and pictures around, and he goes, whack. And I turned to him, I said, "What'd you do there?" He said, "Oh, it's a mosquito." And I just, straight out of my mouth, I said, "They don't want to die, you know." And he looked at me and he went, "Oh, but it was biting me." I said, "Yeah, but they don't want to die. Their life's really precious to them." And then later I went, "Oh, God, that was a bit abrupt." He came to me the next day and he said, "I thought about that all night." He said, "Thank you." He said, "I get it." That's very simple. And that actually came from my son when he was very little, because we'd brought him up as a Buddhist and he never killed anything. And his friend next door, and I heard it from him, I was in the garden or something, and his friend was stepping on ants. And my son Brett said to this kid, they're about seven, he said, "Don't do that, they don't want to die." And his friend went, "Oh, okay." It's such a clearly evident thing. And that's how people get it. Not, oh, it's really wrong to do and you'll get bad karma. No. Recognizing that you're creating suffering in that action. And people get it. We have this innate nature of goodness, actually. I do believe that. Don't think we have innate badness. I think we all want to do the right thing. We don't want to experience suffering. We want good things to happen. Sometimes we have misguided information, but generally we have this desire to look after people, look after our children, look after our parents and things. So we have an innate goodness. Anyway, that's killing. Stealing. Experience congruent with the cause. Next life, lack of wealth. Possessions and resources, your things will be stolen and lost. If, and occasionally in my life, some things have been stolen. And at first there's a frustration and almost a kind of an anger towards the thief. And then afterwards, when I really think about it, I actually envision that I'm actually giving them the present for the thing they've stolen. Because I have to recognize that in a previous life, I created the karma for that to happen. So I don't want it to happen again. So instead of being angry and frustrated, I think, okay, I'll offer that as a gift to you if you really need it. I'd still lock the car though. And the actions congruent with the cause is you have an instinctive tendency to steal. Environmental result, being born in a barren place where crops do not grow or are destroyed by shortages of food, and there are shortages of food. Sexual misconduct, you're unable to keep relationships and you'll have quick to separate from your spouse, family, friends, students and employees. Have a tendency to be unfaithful. So that's the result of sexual misconduct. And so sexual misconduct is harming someone else with your sexual practice, causing someone suffering. That's it. Divisive speech, lying, congruent with the cause, others do not believe you even when you tell the truth. So if you've created that in this life, and I have met someone that actually, in my travels through life, I met someone that was a pathological liar. He had convinced a whole bunch of people that he was a barrister. And he'd done 1 year of law. And he was so clever, he had the right speak and the right way of doing it. He said, oh, I'm not practicing, but he said, I got through the bar, and he said, I was a barrister. And he convinced the whole, and he finally got found out. And it was so embarrassing for him, he actually left town. But we then found out that he'd lied about so many different things. He told me actually he'd been a racing driver. And I believed him. And he hadn't been a racing driver. He also said that he was a chef. He hadn't been a chef. And I know now that he doesn't live in Australia even, because he's left this trail of lies behind him. Terrible suffering. I actually said to him, when I found out about that he wasn't a barrister, I said, why did you do that? He said, I wanted people to like me. Terrible suffering. He actually made up these lies because he thought if he seemed important, people would like him. So there's a huge lack of self-esteem. But it didn't cause him any happiness. He's lying. And he created the habit. This is the habitual cause. He couldn't stop it. Just kept going. Divisive speech. This is where your speech separates people. So what do you think of Bill there? He's kind of honest. Bingo. Divisive speech is where you end up being lonely, having few friends, followers and employees. This is where gossip, where your gossip is harming someone. And we do gossip because we want to feel important, or we have some inside information. You know so-and-so? Yeah, not great. And we create this impression. My dear teacher did a wonderful thing in Melbourne to one of my friends who's a director down there. He gave him the lesson of divisive speech. It was so brilliantly done. It was over a period of months. So all the students had moved into the centre. And my teacher said to this friend of mine, he said, "Oh, you know so-and-so over there? She's very lazy." And this friend of mine didn't know this other guy. They'd all moved in together to share this big, each of these rooms. And my teacher said, "Oh, I see so-and-so over there. He's not, we'll call him Peter. But Peter is, he's very lazy." And my friend went, "Okay, he's very lazy." And gradually over a period of a couple of months, my teacher would go, "Not much fun." And so in the end, my friend, even without really talking to this guy, went, "Oh, this guy's terrible. He's a really shocking bloke. We've got to get rid of him out of the centre." And as he'd finally come to that conclusion, my teacher turned round to him one day and said, "See, Peter, he's our best student." And he said, it was like this big custard top tart in his face. He had built up a complete prejudice on gossip. My teacher had just done this to give him a really clear view that if you believe all this gossip, you will form an opinion about someone without knowing the truth. And he said it was such a wonderful lesson, but he felt so embarrassed. He built up this whole story about how rotten this guy was, when in fact he was actually a really good guy. And he'd believe that prejudice. And that's what we do when we do gossip, or divisive speech, actually. I'll jump a little bit quickly. Harmful intent, where you really, you don't actually harm anyone, but you really have real malice towards them. And interesting result of that is that you become frightened and panic very quickly. This is the karmic result. And you have a tendency to hurt others in your speech or your actions. Okay, so you really have a negative attitude towards people. And then the last one is wrong views, which is not believing in karma and not believing really in the fact that you have the opportunity of becoming free of samsara and becoming enlightened. But also, what else was I going to say? Oh, yeah. You find it difficult to develop realizations and correct understanding. So saying that, I remember someone said, they weren't a Buddhist, they said, "Oh, well, if you don't believe in karma, it won't happen to you." That would, in Buddhism, if you're a Buddhist and said that, that would be wrong, totally wrong view. Because if we're not accountable for our actions, then what are we accountable for? So, we've got a few minutes. Are there any questions on anything we've talked about tonight? So, we'll just go over a little bit. Buddhism in a nutshell. Going right back to the beginning, finding out what creates the right action, doing that. What creates the right attitude? How do you develop it? The beauty about Buddhism is that we have all the techniques there. We have all the techniques of how to develop ourselves. It becomes our own path. It becomes our own direction. Each of us have our own Buddhism. But we have the tools and the guideposts to look at so that we can develop that. And really, what happens is people become happier by doing a practice. If you look at your practice and you're becoming tighter and more constricted, then you're not doing the right practice. If your practice creates more compassion, understanding, wisdom, love, patience with others, then you're doing the right practice. And it's not the big things that you're doing, it's the small things. Walking down the street and seeing someone struggling. Maybe an old lady trying to lift her bag off a curb or something, and just going over and doing that. My teacher walking through a supermarket, I wasn't there at the time, but he was shopping with the other guy at the centre. And he was getting on, he was in his late 60s. He was pushing a trolley through the supermarket, and my friend was just walking beside him, and they were getting things, He said there was a very old lady, he said, just also pushing her trolley. And he said, Geshe Loden just stopped and just went over to her and just took her hand and said, are you okay? And she looked up and said, oh, thank you, yes. Just that, he just recognised she needed a little bit of compassion just at that point, rather than, oh, well, that's her problem. Just those kinds of things. They're the things that change your consciousness. Not, oh, you know, I can do 17 hours of meditation, I'm really good at it. But it's the little actions that we do that actually change your mind. And the more you do that, you'll see opportunities. This is where our awareness and our mindfulness is important. In business, mindfulness is very good for doing our job and you know, doing it well. But really in the Buddha Dharma, it's looking for those opportunities of where we can be helpful, where we can actually see something that needs to be fixed and being aware of that and knowing when to do it and when not to do it. So if you go to see it, if you see a little old lady standing by the edge of the curb and you take her across the road and she doesn't want to go, that's called idiot compassion. All right? Oh, no, I take little old ladies across the road. And you drag your half... And in fact, I did this... I mentioned that teaching I was doing one night at the centre. And this guy goes, yeah, I did that. She started hitting me with her umbrella. If you're going to take someone across the road, ask them first if they need to go. That's called wisdom. and so... By developing that awareness of just being present, and unfortunately, I'm not against mobile phones, but unfortunately, that absorption, even walking down the street, becomes almost too disconnected from the reality that's happening. So be aware of that. You know, we can miss a beautiful day by being absorbed on. What's on our phone? Use the phone to be a tool. Don't let it use you. And so being aware of nature, walking in nature, can be so therapeutic. But not if we're absorbed in future and disconnecting. So in a sense, the internet can be a connection or a disconnection. We can disconnect from our actual immediate surroundings. And that's not great. You miss opportunities, you bump into people for a start. And so developing this present awareness, looking at our mind where it is now and looking at what is going on around us is really essential Buddhism. It's in a nutshell. It's just about how we're acting within our universe, which is very big, something about this big. But seeing those opportunities and using them for the most benefit. And if you can use your mindfulness to be a benefit to others, then you're doing a great job. That's a fantastic practice. There's a practice in Buddhism, in the Tibetan system, called Tundruk, where you say to yourself, you have a little column in a little book. It was originally started by the great Kadampa masters in about the 11th century, 12th century, where they would have a pocket full of black stones and a pocket full of white stones. And they'd say to themselves, okay, today I'm going to be patient. And about midday they go, was I patient in the last few hours? No, black stone in the top pocket. And they look back and they go, in the afternoon they go, actually, all afternoon I was being really patient. A situation came up. They put a white stone. And gradually, over being mindful, because they wanted to change, it wasn't a beat up, it wasn't like, oh, I'm terrible, I've had bad thoughts, or I've been negative. Gradually, over time, they got more and more white stones because they were being mindful about their mind, what was going on. So, you don't have to have a go out and find black and white stones, but you can have a little column and say, okay, today, this morning, for 2 hours, I'm not going to gossip. Or I'm going to be patient. I'm not going to be impatient. And then you check up and you go, okay, tick for the good column or a cross for the bad column. And gradually, that awareness develops, and that's what changes your karma. Just those things. Because we don't often have huge things. We don't go out and save a forest from burning or something. That's not really, a lot of those kind of things happen. So it's the small actions that really change our consciousness, and that develops our wisdom and pushes us further along the path, or leads us further along the path. So look at the small stuff. That's really where our power is. And we only have this moment. So look at what you're doing in this moment. We never get to the future. The future's always our present. So look what we're doing right now, and that becomes beneficial. I've got time for some questions, if there are any questions, any specifics. Do you feel that I have covered that, essentially? Buddhism in a nutshell?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Yeah. Was there any topics that weren't clear on? The emptiness one and dependent origination, I have to apologise, that's a long talk, actually. Really analysing emptiness is not easy. Does anyone struggle with that view of emptiness? You're okay with it? Or is it confusing?
I should have a question.
Yeah?
We're talking about emptiness, right? What's the difference between sleeping and meditation?
What's the difference between sleeping and meditation?
Yeah.
I'm happy to answer that. Sleepiness is this. So, interestingly, okay, no, it's a good question, because They're the two enemies of meditation, where you get so relaxed that you keep losing the object of meditation. That's sleepiness. If that's happening in your meditation, then you have to look at the time that you're meditating. You might be trying to meditate at night when your body's tired. So stop. Because I know of a monk that thought he was... a friend of mine, actually. He thought he was... really early days of his Buddhist practice... he thought he was being really tense. So he developed a really, tried to relax more and more. And he said he ended up developing a meditation on sleeping. He said he just got so relaxed he kept falling asleep all the time. And he didn't correct it. And he said it took him about 2 years to get out of that pattern of getting so relaxed. So you have to be careful that you don't just accept, because relaxation and sleepiness are very close together. And when you relax enough, that's great. But your meditation has to be sharp enough, as though you're reading the most incredible book you've ever read. You know, when you get really absorbed in a book or a movie or something, and you're really present, that's the development, the level of awareness that you need to have for your meditation. That really clear focus. So if you find yourself being sleepy, have a sleep and then do your meditation. Don't try and struggle through, because that won't work either. You're just fighting yourself. That's why it's really good to meditate first thing in the morning. You've had some sleep, and if you can do some meditation in the morning, that's when the mind's the freshest. That's the best time. When I'm teaching meditation, people say, can you meditate at night? Yeah, sure. And they say, oh, well, it puts me to sleep. Then you've got this kind of balance between using your meditation to make you sleep, and it will have a tendency to make your mind dull for the meditation. So it needs to be really, really sharp, as sharp as you can make it. So the enemies of meditation is too much agitation, which is distraction, or sleepiness. And you need to find somewhere in the middle. That's the sweet spot, okay? And as the Buddha said, it's like the string of an instrument. If it's too loose, it's out of tune. If it's too tight, it's out of tune. And you just keep doing it until you find this point where your body is relaxed and your mind is very alert. Really present and alert. And that's the thing you've got to aim for. Thank you. Yep.
So Buddhists say do not kill, right? What about those executors? Like in China, we have capital punishment. Those executors, they are not the policymaker. They are not sentencing them to die, and those people do not want to die. But they do really get karma.
Well, the karma, well, of the karma of the people doing capital punishment. Is that what you mean?
Executioner.
Like those executioners, they are just doing their jobs. It's not them, like, intend to kill these people.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, their action.
Yes.
Yeah. Like in an army or something, they're sent to war and they kill. Yeah, the power of that karma isn't as strong. Okay, because to create a complete karma that we're talking about there, you need four parts. The first one is the object, which is the person. The second one is the intention. The third one is carrying it out, and the fourth one is satisfaction over it. So to create a complete karma, you need those four things. If there is no satisfaction in it, then the result of that karma is not known, okay? And it can be purified a lot easier. So in that situation, like someone who is drafted into the army and then has to go to war and shoot, but they don't want to do it, then the karma is not anywhere near as powerful as the intention to do that. So this is why we have a lot of karmas that they say the result is not clear. You need those four things. And the last one is the satisfaction of doing. So if someone's done that kind of thing, there was a guy who was in the army, and he said during a particular war, he had to be there because he was drafted into the army, but he felt great regret about it, that he might have killed people. He said he wasn't sure about it, but he didn't want to. And so he went to this lama and said, look, I think he was actually during the Vietnam War, American War. And he said, I think I actually possibly killed people. What can I do? Because he then became a Buddhist. And the Lama said to him, look, he said, just because you have regret, that is very good. Now do an action that will help, that is a direct opponent to that. So he went to a farmer who had sheep that he was going to kill for meat, and he saved a flock of sheep, and he paid the farmer to keep those sheep alive. So there was an action in opposition to that. I had the same situation when I was a kid. Because I wasn't a Buddhist, I did kill things, mosquitoes and ants and things, because our family just grew up that way. We weren't Buddhists. And so a number of years ago, I came home one day, and there was a pigeon that was not well sitting on my doorstep, and it bizarrely had climbed up four flights of stairs. And I put some water out for it, and I couldn't see that it was injured, and I put some seed out, and the next morning it was still there. And I went out for a couple of hours, and I said to myself, if I come home, if that pigeon hasn't flown off, then I think I'll take it to a vet. So I went there, and the pigeon wasn't moving. It was just moving about, but it wasn't flying away. So I rang a vet and I said, oh, look, I've got a pigeon here. He said, oh, no, we kill them. But he said, there is a bird doctor in Kensington. No, not Kensington, Alexandria. So I rang the bird doctor. He said, oh, yeah, look, bring it in. So he told me how to wrap it in the towel and bring it in. And I brought it in, and he said, look, by law, he said, we have to put down, because they're not native animals. And I went, look, I have a problem with that. I'm a Buddhist. He went, it's okay. He said, my mother-in-law's a Buddhist. He said, I've worked in Hong Kong. He said, I get it. And then he looked at me and he said, if you say it's your pigeon, if it's your pigeon, it's your pigeon. Oh, you mean my pigeon? He went, yeah. He said, then we can save it, can't we? Because it's your pigeon. I went, yeah, it's my pigeon. I've just named it Daisy. And he went, all right. And he examined it and he said, look, unfortunately, its wing's going to have to come off. because otherwise it'll get infected and die. And he said, it will cost you a bit of money. I said, it doesn't matter. And what I recognized, I had this opportunity there and then to pay for any killing that I had done as a child to save the bird. And the nurse came out and she said, this is great, you know. And she said, no one ever saves pigeons. So I paid for the pigeon and he gave me a discount. It still cost me $500. There you go. I had the opportunity, I had the money. I'm going to pay for the pigeon. Then I went home and he said, we'll ring you in the morning and let you know how Daisy's going. So he said, but she'll be fine. He said, but you will end up having a pigeon. And I went, okay. So I went home and I looked up pigeon. There is pigeon.com, by the way. But I wanted to know how long pigeons live. Guess what? Some of them can live for 35 years. And I just went, okay, if that's my karma. So I went in, I got the pigeon, and he said, now, he said, every morning and afternoon for a week, you're going to have to give it these drops of antibiotics. So I'd go to the cage, and I'd put a towel in, and the pigeon would growl at me. Never heard a pigeon growl. I just speak and I put the droppers down, and then I had to clean the cage every day because actually, pigeons have more droppings than any animal on the entire planet. It could fill its cage in a day. And I thought, this is going to go on 35 years. Oh my goodness. So I just went, okay. That's the karma I got. I got a pigeon. And it was really funny. About a week later, I went to Tai Chi and I was telling this woman at Tai Chi, I said, oh, I've got this pigeon that I'm going to have to look after for 35 years. She said, I'm going to call you later. She said, I think I have a solution. And I went, what? So she rings me. She said, guess what? I've just rung my friend up at Kempsey. She also has a pigeon with one wing.
Aww.
And she said she would love to have your pigeon. She's got a big aviary. And she'll come down and collect it. And they can hang out together. And so there was the solution. And she rang me later. She said, they're in love with each other. They hang out together. They've both got one wing and they walk around in the aviary. So so Daisy had a good life. Thank you very much. That's it.
So for next week, we will be basing on Four Noble Truths and learn more about the suffering. So the topic will be Crossing the Sea of Suffering. It's all about helping others. And the speaker is Venerable Nam Rong. The date is on 16th of March, same time, same place. If you have any questions, you can contact me. It's my number. This is on Friday. And on Thursday, we have Chinese Dharma Talk, as usual. The same speaker, Venerable Nam Rong, and the topic is Triple Gems. The Chinese part, I'll skip it. And yeah, it's from 6:15 to 8 p.m., and it's at Square House 208, which is just right across. And if you want to contact, you can contact JC, who is not here today, and her contact details are here. And we have weekly meditation on Monday and Tuesday. And it is on Monday is at G054. It's at Quad. And on Tuesday it's at Square House 214, which is the same place as the Chinese Dharma Talk. So the time is 3:15 to 3:45. You can contact Mei Yan, who is not also here today. Her contact details are here. So this week we have got our sports session back at Univers. The first sport is gonna be badminton, and it's at University Gym from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. So what you have to bring: water bottle, towel, and if you have badminton racket, please bring along. And if you have any question, please ask Peter, who is sitting over there. So,
sorry, quick question: is there any price?
Oh, is there a price?
$15. You are a universe member, you have to pay $5. If not, you have to pay $8.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
For two hours,
$5.
Very good.
Very good. Please come along. By yourself. So, next week, Saturday, we have got our potluck. So, for that, I would like to invite the organizer, Marco, to give us what potluck is.
Hello everyone, my name is Marco. So, what is potluck? What do you guys think, what is potluck? Anyone? No, it's okay, let me answer your question. Potluck is we bring our own dish of food, we go there, share our own dish, we share our own food, we eat together, have fun together, and we also have games to play together. Why is it good? Because you get to meet new friends, right? What is uni? Uni without friends is sucks. That's why I come to potluck. Remember, it is all vegetarian food since from this year onwards. So please bring vegetarian food. Don't bring KFC, crackers, all the stuff. Thank you. Any questions, guys?
When is it?
Next Saturday. Oh, where is it? Oh, good question. The Lodge. Square House Level 3, which is across from here. So if you guys don't know where is it, you can follow us after this talk. So we will go there together. Okay. Any more questions, guys?
What food are you bringing?
Up to you. As long as it's
you.
Secret dish. Then when you come, then you know. Cannot leak out. So yes, Alina.
Do we have to bring food?
Best that you can bring, but if you don't, it's okay. You can bring your empty stomach. You feel fine with all the stuff. Then just come and eat and enjoy and have fun. Yes.
If I'm not member, can I come?
Yes. It's member. No. Yes. Member still can come. As long as you have fun. Bring all your friends, your family, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your uncle, your auntie. Everyone to come together and have fun. As long as we can meet new friends. Yes.
Is egg allowed?
Wow, such a good question. Yes, of course it is. I like a pause, let you guys to think, is it? So yes, you can bring egg also. So yes, as long as it's no meat, it's okay. So all good? Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Marco. So this semester, we have got a very big event coming up, which is called Buddhist Fair. And for that, I would like to invite our assistant organizer of Buddhist Fair to give us a short presentation. So, Alina.
So this year we have this is a brand new event, sort of. So it's called Buddhism Fair. So by its name it's like a fair, so it's kinda like carnival like. So we have like stalls there, and then we have activities and workshops. I think that's all. In the stalls we have food stalls, we have exhibits and games,
books.
And books, and they're all related to Buddhism. So what we want to bring out from this event itself is to spread Buddhism, and its topic this year is Dhamma awareness. So basically we want to present core teachings of Buddhism. So we will be presenting four noble truths as well. in it, and for measurables and mindfulness and many others. Yeah, I think I missed out a lot of things. Let me remember. Okay, for the food. Okay, so food stall, we are selling vegetarian food there. So yeah, I think eggs is allowed as well. Pretty sure it is. Yeah, and we have barbecue. So vegetarian barbecue. I'm missing a lot of things. Okay, it's coming up in week 5, so 27th to 29th of March, Tuesday to Thursday. And it's during daytime, so for working people, so sorry you can't join us probably, but you can help us setting up and packing up. And you can like watch our videos on Facebook if you follow us. Yeah, it's 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. And yeah, so we're going to have like EDTs, like this sort of talk, so like in English, Dharma talk, and Chinese as well during the week, and also meditation. So I guess what we want to bring out is more of like, we want like all uni students and also staff, or just like basically everyone living around here to know more about Buddhism and actually learn something out of it. Even though they just like pass by and like see something that relates to Buddhism, I guess. So that's that, and the contact details are over there. If you guys want to help us out, please feel free to do so. There are like people who need help, and yeah. So just like contact those people, or me, or Coco, or anyone you know around here. So yeah. Any question? Like, there's lots of questions. Oh, okay. So they're all free except the food. The vegetarian food that we are selling. But the barbecue is also free. It's confusing, okay. But yeah, mostly are free. You don't have to be a member, you don't have to, yeah, register or anything. Any question? No question? Is that right? Okay. Please do come though. It's not gonna be boring. I think it's not gonna be boring.
So if you are at uni and going to lectures in between from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., just
drop by
and
say hi.
Yeah, say hi.
Okay.
Oh,
that rhymes.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. So, before we end this Dharma talk, let us all pay respect to Tripitaka. Respect to Rodley. Thank you everyone for coming. And if you haven't had dinner yet, we will be going to Thai for Thai. So please come along with me. Thank you.
Hey, do you turn this off, Coco? Did you turn this off?
Is it?
No, yeah.
Go. Something. Do you follow it? American
Union. It's called a bear box.
Like,